Good afternoon, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are on listen-only. After the presentation, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. At that time, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star one. I'd like to inform participants that today's call is being recorded. If anyone has any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the call to your conference host today, to Ms. Suzanne Hambrush. You may begin.
Okay, so thank you for coming, and it's a pleasure to introduce David Ferrucci, who's our fifth FY12 Distinguished Lecture, SAIS Distinguished Lecture Series speakers. And we have one more. We had six this year, so this is the fifth one. I'm really delighted to have David here. I have heard him before, and I really, really liked his talk. And he said, oh, it'd be very similar. And actually, that's really good. So I'm happy that's similar. David Ferrucci is IBM Fellow and is the principal investigator of the Watson Jeopardy Project. That work began in 2007, trying to explore the feasibility of designing a system that really can rival human champions at the game of Jeopardy. And in January, February 2011, it actually did, beating Brad Rutter and Ken Jennings. And I think he will tell us some of the way how it was done, but not too much of it.
Right.
Yes. So thank you, and go ahead.
Thank you. So first of all, I apologize that I'm coming, you know, down from a cold, so I may cough or sound a little nasally as I go through this. It's a tremendous pleasure, actually, to have an opportunity and really an honor to speak here at the National Science Foundation. I mean, I've always, science has been my life, really. I have two young daughters who both want to be scientists, too, so it's exciting to have come, you know, this far with my interest and my passion and my career. So it's, it feels good to be here. Yes, I want to talk to you a little bit about the Watson, the computer that won the Jeopardy, and really what it's all about. You know, why IBM took this challenge on, and what it really means, I think, for both science and the business. Why would IBM take like something like this on at all? And, you know, we have this tradition now with these grand challenges, and there's a few things that, you know, the company looks for. One is to drive important scientific advances, you know, to define a problem that we know that if we were able to accomplish it, we would really push the scientific field forward. But we're also a business, and it's important to be able to do something that, you know, has significance to IBM customers, and it's really exciting and helps us communicate to the broader audience if we can do something also that captures the broader imagination, you know, of the general public. And I think Deep Blue, in many ways, the chess computer that beat Garry Kasparov, was one of those kinds of challenges. It got people to think a little bit about, wow, what can computers do? What is the limits of computation? How does computer intelligence compare to human intelligence? It helped us advance ideas in parallel and high-performance computing that was relevant to the customers. And, you know, it drove important advances, obviously, in science as well. So it kind of captured those three things. And I think you'll see that Jeopardy was an idea that also, hit on these three points as well. But, of course, it's a very different, it represents a very different kind of problem. Right? If we compared the task of playing chess to the task of really understanding and, you know, questions and dealing with human language, we see two very different kinds of problems. And it's interesting to reflect on them, right? Because if we think about chess as well-defined, you know, mathematical problem, right? There's a limited number of moves, a limited number of pieces, there's a finite board. In some sense, it's a very mathematical problem. Everything is unambiguously defined. And the computer, albeit has to be powerful and smart and has to navigate this large search space. But nonetheless, when you think about that and you step back a bit, it's more of a mystery to me that humans can play chess than the computers can play chess. I don't think that we traditionally thought that way. We thought, wow, you know, humans are really smart, you know, and they are, and they have a particular kind of intelligence. But, you know, once you kind of really start to understand the problem, like, wow. Language is really on the other end of the spectrum. here we have, you know, humans are prolific at this. I mean, we're like language machines. We communicate with each other in language. We write in language. We don't even think about it. How we users are always doing it, and we create languages within sublanguages within sublanguages. We're just always creating languages, and this is just so natural to human cognition. It's nothing like, you know, a mathematical problem, right? It's very ambiguous. It's extremely contextual. What any word means, you know, depends so much on its context and its usage. Its meaning is actually, you know, changing. You know, speaking about my daughters, I mean, now Laura's 10 and Nina's 8. A couple of years ago, there's an interesting scenario where I would spend a lot of time in my house, you know, trying to engage the kids, particularly in science. So a very common experience in my household was, guys, come down here, you're going to see this. It's really, really interesting. Doing some experiment in the kitchen sink or trying to program the robot to do something interesting and the next robot, you know, just trying to get them really excited about these projects. Come down here, it's really, really interesting. And they'd run down and they would look at this. This was a common experience. And one time, Nina stopped at the top of the stairs. Daddy? Yes? I think interesting things are boring. So, and she still wants to be a scientist, so I'm not giving up on her. But, you know, what was interesting about that was she wasn't really making a joke. She was being very serious. I mean, this is what the word for her came to mean. You heard it enough times, and enough times I bored the out of her, that, you know, she said, gee, interesting means boring. This was her experience with the word. This is the meaning that it took on. And that's, you know, what language is like. It's all about, you know, the usage. What does it mean? And for humans, we're connecting the meaning comes from associating that word and that phrase with the experience in which that word or phrase occurs. We're connecting it to our cognitive experiences. It's not like it's well-defined in some completely circumscribed mathematical definition. It's really not like that at all. So it's a very human thing. How do you get computers to deal with this? They can't ground those words. They can't ground the meaning of those words in human experience. Contrary to popular belief, computers are not human. They don't have human experience, right? It's just a bunch of zeros and ones. But this wasn't, as we started to talk more and more about the Jeopardy problem to a broader and broader audience, one of the things we learned is that, you know, it seems like people's understanding of computers, the general public, is very opaque. It's actually quite surprising for someone who's been in, you know, computer science my whole life and so has been sort of an AI guy and always thinking about this. It was shocking to find out that people are really clueless. I mean, they use, you know, iPhones and computers all the time, but they don't really know what's going on inside. And so we started talking about what's hard and what's easy for a computer. Because, you know, we were getting this almost this bipolar reaction. Where some people, you know, we would talk about the whole Jeopardy thing and computer playing Jeopardy, and some people would say, well, wait a second, what's the big deal? Don't computers know everything? And then on the other end of the spectrum, people would come and say, you're going to take over like Skynet. Watson's going to eat our children. You know? So, you know, there was just this bipolar reaction, which clearly is like, you know, what's really going on out there? You know, do people really kind of get it? What's easy, what's hard for a computer? I had a radio show host, a radio show out in San Francisco, California, wanted to interview me, the live radio show. This was before the game. And so he starts off the interview and he says, so, computers can play Jeopardy, so how's this going to work? So you're going to put all the clues into like a spreadsheet, and then with all the answers, and then when it shows up on the screen, the computer's going to look up the clue and speak out the answer, right? You know, so I'm horrified. You know, so, you know luckily it was like radio and not television, because I would have been rolling my eyes. You know, so, no, I mean, the computer doesn't have the answers, doesn't even know what questions it's going to be asked. So the guy goes, well, then how's it do it? So exactly. That's, you know, now you're getting it. Now it's thinking it. How do you do it? So we started talking about, you know, what's easy and what's hard for a computer. So here's the natural log of 12,500,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000, cubed divided by 34,600.47. Anybody? greater than or less than 1. So 50-50. Anybody? So computers not, I mean, humans not so good. Computers, you know, very, very good at this. I actually gave a talk once where a guy actually got it right. I mean, within like a decimal place or two. So if you're really good at logs and magnitudes and numbers, you can actually approximate this pretty rapidly. But still, it was scary. Now, that same person had never heard of the game Jeopardy. So, I know what that tells you. How many people have actually saw the game with Watson? Wow. Oh, yeah, right, I'm at the end of stuff. How many people rooted for Watson? The rest of you can leave. Okay. So there are some humans here. So what else are computers good at? So select the payment where the owner equals David Jones and the type of product equals the laptop. That's like a pseudo SQL, structured query language query. And so computers are really good at navigating tables. You put all this information in a table. We call them relational databases. And then you could look up David Jones in one column and get a serial number and then map that to another table and get invoices and navigate that over to the payment. And the computer knows that David Jones is David Jones because, well, you know, it's a bunch of characters represented numbers. Computers are really good at numbers, and they compare. Is the number representing the D the same as the number representing the D, the A, the A? So David Jones must be David Jones. Of course, you can confuse the computer really quickly. You put Dave, you know, Jones in the query and David Jones in the table, and it's gone, lost, doesn't know anything anymore because D's not a space. So does it really understand who these people are? No, not really. Now you have to make the computer smarter. You have to put in, you know, maybe you have to give it and tell it what nicknames are, and then these things maybe could match. But what do? You don't really do that, right? You just say, you know what, let's use unique identifiers. Let's use Social Security numbers. Let's use numbers that uniquely identify the individual so we don't have this complicated problem of ambiguity, not knowing what things really mean. And so that's how we do it. So computers are really good at this. You know, billions of rows really, really quickly. This is what drives so many computer systems, business systems. So if I had this question, where was X born? And I told the computer, you know what, here's how to represent this query, and you can put you in your SQL, because the answer is going to be in a table like that. Or if you bind Albert Einstein to X, you look up his birthplace. So you look up the name in the first column, the answer is in the second column. We call that structured. Because the semantics, the actual meaning is defined by the table. I know that ahead of time I write a query that can be answered with that table. So what unstructured means, I don't know what the query is going to be. I didn't anticipate it. I didn't write a SQL query for it. I didn't even know what it's going to say, what words are going to be used in it. And I just get this, where was I born? And now I read a bunch of stuff, and somewhere I read one day from among the city views of Ulm, I don't know if it was a water code sent to Albert Einstein as remembered by his son's birthplace. The answer's there, but to get it, I kind of have to know, well, why is the answer there? Who are the people? Where are the places? How the birthplace? How do you need to do with being born? Why does this answer a where question? So, you know, if you start saying, I'm going to ask you any kind of question, and you have to read a bunch of stuff and get the answer, this isn't looking things up in a database. This gets a lot more complicated. I have to do more analysis of the text and the question and understand where an answer might be and interpret that. So here's another one. X ran this. And I have, I looked at, if I knew what X ran this, what I meant by that, everyone has to ask, I can look up Jack Welch, who's the CEO of GE, and I can get GE. But imagine I just get the string, Southwest ran this, I don't know what that means, and I read, if leadership is an art, then surely Jack Welch has proven himself a master painter during his tenure at GE. I might get with some level of confidence that Jack Welch is a painter at GE. But you start to see where things kind of get complicated with natural language. I just, for the heck of it, you know, pulled out, because one of the places we're taking Watson is in medicine. And, you know, medicine is fraught with this kind of problem. Like, there's lots of information in textbooks and reference material and doctors' notes. And it's expressed in all kinds of different ways. So how can I match what's going on in a patient's case to all the literature and what might be going wrong or right with them if I can't really understand how to work out all this language? So food would get stuck when she was swallowing. It actually means the same thing as can cause food to move slowly in the esophagus. It's the same thing as swallowing difficulty, which is the same thing as food gets held up. How do I know all these phrases have an equivalent or similar meaning? It could depend, you know, when things can change meaning, terminology can affect meaning, the terms are not the same, do they really mean the same thing? Causation changes meaning. It can cause food to move slowly is the same thing as a swallowing difficulty. Chronology, is the sudden onset of chills the same thing as chills? There's subtle differences in the meaning depending on the context. It's the same thing as cold or coryza. Fever, temperature, high temperature. Well, everyone's got a temperature. Not everybody has fever. Fever after acute symptoms subside can mean something very different of what's happening in that particular patient's case. So magnitude, chronology. Location, flank pain, same thing as lower back pain, same thing as kidney pain, same thing as between, pain between the upper abdomen and the back. Right, so location can change, can different ways to express it. This is kind of becomes a non-trivial problem when you think about all the different ways different things might be expressed. So along comes Jeopardy. Jeopardy is kind of an interesting problem because what it does is it sets us up to say, you know what, if you can do really well at this, you're pushing the science along some critical dimensions in the space of question answering and better language processing. So for one, you know, broad open domain, they ask about all kinds of things, so I can't just anticipate all the things they're going to be asked. So if you're standing in the direction, you should look to check out the wainscoting. Anybody? Down. Yeah, that's right. So interior design. What's interesting about this, if you thought, you know what, I saw that question now, so I'm going to nail this. I'm going to be able to answer every question about direction. Directions. So let me see. So I'm going to build a database and I'm going to put in all the different sites. So what kinds of directions are there? There's north, south, east, west. Tell you what, let's just do all the degrees around a compass. So let's express directions as degrees around a compass. And then I could group things to the north, south, east, west. You know, so it gets complicated pretty quickly. But then I got to capture the up, down, the right, you know, the right, left. Got to capture that as well. And then maybe in front of me, you know, behind me, you know, there's all that, right? So then there's another Jeopardy question that says this is the direction of fabric. The answer was grain. How many people were going to put grain in their taxonomy for direction? How many people? Not one. Right, so how do you anticipate the meaning of words in different contexts? So interior design. In cell division, mitosis splits the nucleus, and cytokinesis splits this liquid, cushioning the nucleus. Anybody? Cytoplasm? The 600? Cytoplasm is right. The first person mentioned by name in The Man in the Iron Mask is this hero of a previous book by the same author. Anybody for 1,000? 1,000 peanuts? D'Artagnan is the correct answer, D'Artagnan. And so, of the four countries in the world, the one that U.S. does not have diplomatic relations with, the one that's farthest north, North Korea. That recently might have changed. That's the cool, weird thing about information. It's kind of like changing. It's changing. I hate that. Makes life difficult. But so, happens a lot, though. So interior design, cellular biology, you know, classic literature, you know, geopolitics, broad open domain, complex language. You have to be really good, high precision. I'm going to tell you how high in a minute, but to really compete with the best at this game, you have to be able to get a lot right. And you have to know what you know, which was really a fascinating and important challenge scientifically. You just can't buzz in willy-nilly, oh, yeah, I got something. I found something. Yeah. Search will always find something. In fact, search will always find about a million things. You have to produce an accurate confidence, the probability that your answer is right, because if you buzz in and get that wrong, you lose a dollar value associated with that clue, and you give an advantage to your two competitors who now can take the time, you know, the extra time to come up with a better answer and also benefit from the wrong answer that you provide. You think I've said that before? Once or twice. so accurate confidence, you have to be able to predict that probability. You have to do this really quickly. I mean, you know, you really need to be competitive. You have to kind of get that confidence in that answer in about 3 seconds. So this actor, Audrey's husband, from 1954 to 1968, directed her as Rhyme of the Bird Girl in Green Mansions. What's the question asking for? They're asking for the director of Green Mansions, really. So it's asking for the director of the film Green Mansions. It says actor, but no one really knows this person to be an actor. The answer is Mel Farrar. So we don't really know. I mean, I'm the guy who looks at the Jeopardy question, and after it's answered, and they've moved on to the next one, I'm still going, what did it say? What was the clue again? I'm that guy. That's how good I am at this. So we have to parse the sentence. So this is a grammatical parse. The main verb is directed. And you'll see that, you know, it's directed her, it's an actor, and then there's modification, right? So the actor is the husband of Audrey, whoever Audrey is. And this expression from 1964-1968 modifies the husband, modifies the director, the actor, so forth. Directed her as Rima, who is a girl, who is a bird. So that's very confusing. But this is what the computer gets when it parses it. That's the syntactic part. It doesn't know what any of this actually means. So now you have to apply some other analysis and start to assign some semantics. So is Audrey a person? Is director, is that directs a movie or guides or leads? Is this a time, a year, a duration? Is Rhyme a person, a bird, a girl, a character? Green Mansions is a place, a movie, a play, a book, a house. What does it mean in this context? So there's lots of questions, both in terms of how to parse the sentence syntactically, how to apply semantics to it, and if you make any commitment at this stage of the game and you shut down all the other possibilities, like, you're lost. You have to really start to say, well, I don't really completely understand this. In other words, I can make mistakes at any part of this. So I have to be able to pursue a computation down many different possibilities and see what happens down the line. An ACCA resolution, what does her refer to? You know, so anything like that. So one of the things you might be thinking about is, wow, high-performance computer people in here, parallel processing, going to have to pursue many different threads at once. We looked at about 20,000 Jeopardy questions, and we tried to say, how broad is this domain? You know, can I really build a database and anticipate all the questions that are going to be asked and every way they're going to be phrased? And one of the things we looked at is what kinds of things do they ask about? You know, like this direction, this book, this actor, blah, blah, blah. And we got this frequency chart, and you see this really long tail phenomenon. So even if you, there are 20,000 questions, even if you try to tackle the head of the tail, you cover less than 10% of the data. So, you know, things like lady, product, province, month, maker, object, disease, are basically all equivalent in terms of their weight, their significance of the problem. 13% of the questions didn't refer to anything at all. It's just said, like, this or it. So this is already down to 87%. So this is a very broad problem. There wasn't going to be any easy way to anticipate the question, look it up in a database. We really had to try to use textual resources, analyze the question, analyze what we were reading, encyclopedias, dictionaries, thesauri, the Bible, screenplays, books, whatever, and try to find potentially supporting answers with their supporting evidence and then score that evidence. Does it really answer the question? But can I get some other evidence to support whether or not this is the right answer kind of thing? So here's a question. So Lincoln Block, Treasury Secretary Chase, just again in this, meets the third time. Guess what, pal? This time I'm accepting it. Anybody? Resignation is the right answer. Now, did you actually know the historical fact, or did you just say plausible inference? Yeah. So that me too, didn't know the history, so submitted what? So how do you use a plausible inference? What kinds of things do you submit? And what kinds of things would you submit in the context of a president? And what kinds of things you would submit that are even worth asking about, right? Because you use that kind of computation too, right? But I submitted a lot of things, but I'm going to ask for a resignation because that's kind of more significant, more relevant. So all these things come into coming up with a plausible inference. And in fact, yeah, the answer is resignation. Now, we gave this presentation to a sixth grade, and they didn't know the history either. Don't feel bad. And they use plausible inference too, and they can all get different answers. The answer was. Because in their context, interesting is boring. You submit a friend request. You don't submit a resignation. What is that? So context, meaning, and you know, with context, it allows us to be predictive, which is important for trying to answer things, right? Because you have to come up with hypotheses. You have to predict what might be true and then take that prediction and take the next step. And context helps you to predict. In this case, the sixth graders got it wrong. So one of the things Watson does is analyze large volumes of text, and we do that syntactic analysis on it. You know, we do that, get that, you know, grammatical structure, if you will, like that kind of diagramming thing. Subject, verb, object, prepositional phrase, object, preposition, blah, blah, blah. And then we do some semantic analysis. So person, place, thing, you know, inventor, and we do that different ways. And then we generalize. So we generalize by doing, you know, induction statistics. It can be statistics over that. So we say, you know, if you ask me what is an inventor likely to patent, it would be an invention. Now you may say, well, gee, that's pretty obvious. Some computers already know that. Not this computer didn't know that, right? We didn't write down all these billions of axioms that might be true. We kind of learn them from reading. So officials submit resignations. People earn degrees at schools. Well, that seems silly. Well, you ask me where this person earned a degree, and Watson would answer, you know, a state. Didn't even know that you wanted a school. Why would it know that? That's kind of common sense. But if I computed on these statistics over large volumes of content, so, well, this person is probably asking for a school, because that's what people talk about mostly, people getting degrees in school. Fluid is a liquid. Liquid is a fluid. Anybody, which one's actually true?
Liquid
is a type of fluid. Fluid is a more general thing, so plasma and gas is a type of fluid. But you know what? When people use language, they don't really care that much. No offense to physicists. But, you know, fluid, liquid, whatever, same thing. And in fact, that's, you know, what we've learned from analyzing the text. Vessels think. So what's most likely to think? Well, it depends on the context, right? So the other thing we do is when we extract this information and then generalize, we'll also extract the representation of the context. So vessels are likely to sink in the ocean, but if you're talking about the game of pool, it's an eight ball or a cue ball is most likely to sink. And so we'll learn all this stuff. The computer will learn this stuff on its own. This becomes helpful. So now in cell division, mitosis splits the nucleus and cytokinesis splits this liquid, cushioning the nucleus earlier today, someone won 200 peanuts with the right answer with cytoplasm. But Watson will look at this, you know, diagram the sentence, interpret different ways, weight the terms and the phrases, do many, many searches, and generate many possibilities. We call hypotheses, also candidate answers, possible answers. So organelles, actual cytoplasm, plasmatic concrete blood, might be 100 of these. And then each one becomes the root of a new computation where now Watson goes out and says, okay, I want to try to now get some proof. I want to see which of these can I gather more believable evidence than one is right over the other. And it looks for different dimensions of evidence. So one kind of evidence it looks for is that answer, you know, like cytoplasm, is it what the question's asking for? The question's asking for a liquid. So an organelle liquid, a vacuole liquid, a cytoplasm liquid. So in fact, it reads cytoplasm as a fluid surrounding the nucleus. Well, that's an interesting bit of evidence. If I only knew that fluid was a type of liquid, I could start to make that connection, and I could take that passage, that piece of evidence, and I could use it to increase my beliefs, to increase my confidence that cytoplasm is the right answer. So now it generates an intermediate hypothesis that says, is fluid a liquid? And one of the things it uses, of many different algorithms it uses to try to determine this, it uses one that goes and consults WordNet, which is the resource created at Princeton, which is a taxonomy of synthesis, you know, concepts represented by words. and it says it's fluid and liquid, and WordNet has the true taxonomy in there. It knows that the answer is no to that, or at least as far as it knows, that's not true. So in fact, it says, can't help you. But then it goes to that knowledge base that it automatically built from reading lots of natural language texts. Yeah, it's some evidence that fluid could be a liquid. And so it could boost its confidence that cytoplasm can be classified as a liquid. But why does it believe that? Why would it believe the knowledge it extracted from that naturally occurring text over something like WordNet? And the answer is training, machine learning. The answer is it works in the context of the problem I've defined. That's really the answer. We get that through machine learning. So in other words, we'll run lots and lots of questions, and we'll use these algorithms. These algorithms compete. And what happens is that when you're answering Jeopardy questions, this algorithm and its associated resource gains weight. In other words, the system learns that this is trustworthy. This is predictive of the answer. As much as that is, in some cases, maybe more. If you trained on physics tests, you can expect that this would not earn a lot of weight. It would not learn to trust this. It wouldn't be predictive of the answer as much as WordNet would, because this was a more reliable resource for that task. So when you have hundreds of algorithms like this, you have to learn the weights. What works in the context of your training data? Training data in this case was Jeopardy questions. So I'm giving you an insight into how Watson works. I'll show you the architecture in a little while. In May 1898, Portugal celebrated the 400th anniversary of this explorer's arrival in India. Anybody? Excellent. So I want to talk about different kinds of evidence, right? So here's, you can look at this at this question as a bunch of keywords. And we all know keywords are pretty cool. They're pretty powerful. In fact, they would light up this passage. In May, Gary arrived in India after he celebrated his anniversary in Portugal. Right? It's fantastic. It's got May, it's got anniversary, it's got Portugal, it's got India, and it suggests Gary is the explorer in question. And who's to say Gary's not an explorer? All explorers in our own way? No, but in all seriousness, the next sentence might read, and Gary returned home and explored his attic looking for a photo album. So now you have evidence that Gary is the subject of the verb to explore. What better definition do you want for an explorer? Right? The person explores or explore. We'll use that to judge things like that. But of course, the human looks at that and says, wait a second. I have an entire country celebrating the anniversary of this explorer. This has got to be one of the three people I remember from high school history: Columbus, Magellan, or Da Gama. Peter didn't go to high school history. So this is a form of evidence. We don't want to throw this out. But we want to be able to find better evidence. So here's another passage. On the 27th of May, 1498, Vasco da Gama landed in Cabot Beach. Now, this paragraph only has one keyword. It only has the keyword in common, May, which is, means a bunch of different things. It's ambiguous. It's all over the place. Why would I even look at this passage? So I have to look far and wide. I have to consider a lot of content. And then once I get it, I can't just throw it out. There's only one keyword. I have to say, well, is there any set of algorithms or ideas I have that are going to allow me to understand it relative to this question, allow me to match it, if you will. So, well, temporal reasoning allows me to say, well, if something happens, if it's the 400th anniversary in 1898, then that could refer to 1498. Physical paraphrasing allows me to say, well, if I arrive somewhere, I may land there. So, again, I didn't write down all these axioms because I didn't predict all these questions and how the question may relate to what's being said in the content. I mean, I'm not going to get there anytime soon. So, but what I can do is by analyzing lots of language, I can find out that there's, these words are used in similar contexts, so there's some reason to believe they might mean the same thing. I have to be willing to deal with all kinds of uncertainty. I'm not saying anything is absolutely true all the time, but I'm getting some signal. With geospatial reasoning, here's where I actually use a database, and I say, well, Cabot Beach is a location, and in fact, it's in India. So with containment relationship, I can sit there and say, this is matching. So maybe Vasco da Gama is an explorer in question. Can I get any evidence that Vasco da Gama is an explorer? Yeah, I can. There's a lot. So now, am I 100% sure Vasco da Gama is right? No, not even close. But do I have more evidence and more believable evidence, or evidence I can associate stronger confidence with than I do with the keywords? Yeah, I do. So I'm liking Vasco da Gama better than Gary, or more than Gary. Was 60 Minutes premiered the same as U.S. President? Anybody?
Gerald Ford.
Oh, somebody said it. Johnson. Wouldn't it be Johnson's right answer? What's interesting about this question is, you know, who writes this? You know, who writes this? You know, okay, so Jeopardy writers write these questions. But, you know, there's something more fundamental here, which is that when you write something down, when you write an essay, an article, a reference book, whatever, you don't anticipate all the questions that someone else is going to ask and how they're going to phrase them. You want information. A user comes to a problem in a way that's different than the way someone else wrote down the knowledge that they could potentially use. So this person's coming at it in an interesting way, but not the way anybody wrote it. So it's not just a simple, finding, you know, here's a possible answer. Does this passage say the right thing? Do I understand the language? I really have to start breaking this down. Because when I try to answer this question, I can't get a good answer. So first of all, I have to know I'm not getting a good answer. I'm not getting good confidence. Then I have to decompose the question and say, well, maybe I can get 160 minutes from it first, get 1968, pose a new question. In 1968, this man was U.S. president, get Lyndon B. Johnson. So one thing Watson does is he'll break questions down into subparts. He'll solve those subparts independently and then put the pieces back together. And this way, and there are other strategies for putting the pieces back together. Does this mean it gets all questions where you have to break it down into parts? Right? No, it doesn't get them all right. But this is one of the strategies it uses. Shirts, TV, remote controls, telephones. Anybody?
Button.
Very good. Button. Now, you know, I find the answer uniquely human because we did, you know, spreading activation, and we found there are oils, plastics, things under my couch, things made by man. Lots of things that are common, right? Didn't matter how much I complained to the Jeopardy producers about this. They insisted the answer was really just buttons. Right, so don't forget, you know, human questions written for humans. We have a computer in the mix here. It makes it more complicated. So we call that the missing link, you know, the thing that these three concepts have in common. But sometimes it's not obvious. Like, that's a common bomb question in Jeopardy where they, you know, you explicitly know they're looking for the missing link. But here's the question. On hearing of the discovery of George Mallory's body, he told reporters he still thinks he was first.
Hillary.
Edmund Hillary's the right answer. Of course, to kind of get that, you had to make that leap from George Mallory to Mount Everest. And then who was first at Mount Everest? So we think of Mount Everest as a missing link. You have to start putting together kind of a chain of inferences, if you will, or a chain of associations. And, of course, it gets complicated because, you know, lots of other things are related to George Mallory. Why am I leaping off of Mount Everest? So how are the different things that I, you know, that are related to George Mallory, how they relate to the rest of the question? What kinds of things can you be first at? Right. So there's different ways to slice and dice. This is why the final Jeopardy questions were like this. When you're working in medicine, it's very much like this. You have to find a chain of connections, if you will, to get to the answer. And you have to know that the missing link is not the answer. For a long time. You know, the project was about 4 years, but there was sort of a period where we were struggling with what's an answer with a missing link. Right? So you have to kind of be able to say, wait a second, you know, that's not good enough. I have to get smarter about what the answer is and what, you know, what's needed to get to the answer. And actually, this is kind of interesting because, you know, this work has been done by Dr. Swanson, who used text analysis to find connected paths to generate hypotheses. You know, so looking at text associated with Raynaud's disease and blood viscosity, found that connecting thing being fish oil, used that to generate the hypothesis, maybe fish oil can help with Raynaud's disease. That then got, you know, clinically tested and proven. But the hypothesis was generated from doing the text analysis and finding the connection. So that gives you kind of a sense of the classes of things that the Watson system was going to have to deal with in terms of processing language and understanding questions and computing evidence. But how good did it have to be to win? And this is a graph that captures that. We used it as a way to measure Watson's performance over time. And the way to think about this is the dots in the center of the graph, these are, we call this the winner's class. These are actual games, Jeopardy games, and what I'm doing is I'm plotting the performance of the winner of those games. So, take the center of the green cloud, pretend you see a dot in the center of the green cloud there, and draw that down to the x-axis, and the x-axis is the percent answered. So the number of questions, the percent of questions in the game that the winning player was confident enough and fast enough to buzz in for and get to answer that question. So about, if, again, you go down from the center of the green cloud, you're nearly 50%. That means the winning player is confident and fast and winning questions away from the two competitors. They're getting way more than their share. Right? If it fell randomly, each one would get about a third. And then, only 33%, but we're getting over here. And then they're doing between 85 and 95% precision. That's really good. They're getting between 85 and 95% of those questions that they were fast enough to buzz in for and confident enough to get right. The red cloud is Ken Jennings. Ken Jennings, on average, was confident enough and fast enough to buzz in for about 62%, acquire 62% of the entire game on average, sometimes 70 and 81%. 81%, that means you're just watching Ken Jennings answer questions. You don't even know who else is playing. And so he's really, how do you do that? I mean, you just have to assume you know all things. Unfortunately, he was right about that. He did about 92%, precision on average. But you'll see, there are games he won with only answering 40%. There are games he won with, of the questions he answered, he got, just 81% right, only answered 51%. So it depends on the competition. It depends on what was in the game. Some games he was better at, some games he was not as good at. So there's a bit, and of course there are daily doubles. So there's a big luck element, in Jeopardy. What categories are you pulling? Who are you playing against? Did you get the daily doubles? Did you not get the daily doubles? Who in their right mind would bet their career on getting a computer to play this game, given those luck elements? So, this was when we had a kind of state-of-the-art question-answering system. Had a lot of state-of-the-art techniques in it. It had been a small project, though, typical kind of research project, 3 to 5 people. And we took that system and we turned it, on Jeopardy, and it got this confidence curve. And what this says is that the way to think about this, a little bit tricky, is the way to read that confidence curve is imagine that you had all the questions and the system determined the confidence, how sure it was getting it right, and then delivered the answer. And what it did is it ranked all the answers based on the confidence, so from the highest confidence to the lowest confidence. So if you look right here, this says on 5% of the questions that it had the highest confidence in its answer, it got 47% right. As it had less and less confidence, in other words, more and more questions, but now my confidence is going down, it was doing worse and worse, and it ultimately plateaued at about 15%, or less than 15%. That left, of course, a really big gap between that performance and the winner's cloud, and that's when most of the team turned around and left. Harry was like, really? Really? Some people were very frightened. But for the most part, we had a fantastic team, very talented people, dedicated people, and this just incented them even more. So this is a challenge we took on in 2007, is to move that state-of-the-art capability from performing at that level to slicing across that winner's cloud. So what were some principles? Some principles were we weren't going to get this done by building some big database of questions and answers, too slow, too narrow, too brittle, too biased. We really had to do that analysis of existing natural language content. Intelligence from a combination of many. There wasn't going to be one algorithm that solved the problem. There's no silver bullet. One guy came to me in the beginning of the project and said, Dave, for us to succeed at this, we need Maxwell's equations at QA. Where we just have this equation that can answer any question. I said, if that's true, we're screwed. This really needs to be built on the decades of natural language processing, information retrieval, machine learning. We need to figure out how to put these capabilities together in an architecture that will allow us to advance them rapidly and solve this problem. And that's ultimately what we did. Many different methods, many different algorithms, combining them together, continually learning, given the data. And that massive parallelism would be a key enabler. Because we were going to have to look at different interpretations of the question. different possible answers, different paths toward answers, different collections of evidence. How do we do all this and fast enough to compete in Jeopardy? We're going to have to do a lot of it in parallel. So we ended up what we call deep QA. So this is from a high level, the architecture of the software architecture of the system. So you have the question and the topic and the category, you analyze it. You may have to break the question up into different parts and pursue each part in parallel, like that, you know, 60 Minutes Premiere thing, other questions like that. The first step you'll do is you'll analyze the question and the topic, and you'll generate many, many searches. You'll come back with hundreds of possible answers or candidate answers. Could be 100, could be 75. This was a dial we would turn to manage the system, is how many candidates you would come up with, because every time you came up with another candidate, you were spawning a whole other thread to the system. So let's say for the sake of argument you had 100, now let's say you had 10 pieces of evidence to see if you could support that candidate as the right answer. So now you have 1,000 evidence answer pairs, right? And then for each evidence answer pair, we have 100 algorithms. Each algorithm scoring that evidence answer pair. You could potentially end up with millions of scores. You have to combine them all. So if I have each evidence answer pair, you know, Christopher Columbus, some passage, right, the evidence, and I have some algorithm that scores it, then I have this other score. How do I weigh one algorithm's contribution to that answer over another algorithm? There's hundreds. How do I get those away? Well, that's what the machine learning's for. We'd run the entire system on a whole bunch of questions, and the machine learning would look for those weights, that how to balance all those various algorithms, what are the coefficients, so that when I combine them all together, I'm more predictive of the right answer than the wrong answer. So that collection of weights is called a model. So we come up with many models. The reason why we had different models was because different classes of questions. Like, if you're solving an anagram, you're going to balance those algorithms very differently than if you were solving a history question or something like that. So then we came up with different models for different fundamental classes of questions. With that architecture, with that approach, we now had to take those, we had to now develop new algorithms and advance our base capabilities and continue to iterate on that to make Watson smart enough to play Jeopardy. So it wasn't like we came up with that architecture and we were done. That is just the hard work began, the research of advancing those algorithms. And just to give you a taste of where we were, you know, as we evolved, this was an early version of Watson and some of the questions and answers it gave. So actual Jeopardy questions. The American Dream. Decades before Lincoln, Daniel Webster spoke of government made for, made by, and answerable to them. Anyone? But people Watson? No one. So this was an actual, you know, Watson answer, you know, early on in development, but, you know.
Exactly.
New York Times headlines. An exclamation point was warranted for the end of this in 1918. Very good, Watson. Watson? There you go. I sent you. So now I argue, you know, an exclamation point ends a sentence. It really doesn't matter what year. I don't really get the problem. So the answer was World War I. Milestones. In 1994, 25 years after this event, one participant said, "For one crowning moment, we were creatures of the cosmic ocean." What was that? Apollo moon landing, did someone say? Yeah, Watson. The Big Bang. Not a lot of people around to comment on the Big Bang. I understand there were just one or two, really. And right, so they're right. Now you have to understand. Now, you know, as you know, the scientists and the team working on this, at that stage of the game, the fact that we answered with an event, and I was like, wow, we answered with an event. Good thing. Yeah, Powell was the moon. The Queen's English, give a tinkle when you get into town and you've done this. Oh, I'm on the phone, Watson. Again, I thought that was right. Oh, I'm on the phone. And the last one, not all of these you can kind of see, each one of these kind of represents this challenge. You should think, oh, This one, I'm not sure what this one explains, but I'll show it to you anyway. Fatherly nickname. This Frenchman was the father of bacteriology. That's true, very good. Awesome. So you can just imagine on that one we're just like. So what really a big part of what we did was develop a methodology on how to take a lot of different researchers working on many different algorithms and advance them rapidly, combined. So it was really a methodology for innovating rapidly, very goal-oriented. We had this end-to-end system metric. We need to get better at our precision and our confidence. We need to move that line forward towards the winner's cloud. So there was very much a focus on coming up with algorithms, but, you know, there wasn't a single hero or a single technology that was going to make all of a sudden change the world. In fact, algorithms would have 2% impact, 0.5% impact. In the early stages, you might come up with an idea, and you put it into the system, and you get 5% alone by yourself. You're like, wow, incredible, you know. But then 6 months later, that 5% got eaten away, and all of a sudden, your algorithm was having 0.5% impact because other people were coming up with other algorithms that were overlapping in their impact. And you could sit there and say, well, what do you have stuff that's overlapping for? Well, the alternative was to come up with some master design that anticipated all possible variables and interactions between all those algorithms. That wasn't going to happen. We wouldn't have written a line of code for 5 years. So this was a methodology that says, yeah, you go in and you develop that algorithm. We're going to integrate. We're going to train. We're going to try to understand. We're going to try to make the right bet. But in the end, the performance is going to tell us, you know, what's working and what isn't working. So extreme collaboration. We all got into one room, really tried to work together as a team and to communicate. Very, very high bandwidth communication. Who's doing what? What are you working on? To minimize really, you know, obvious overlap, you'd sit there and say, well, what are you doing? Well, I'm going to go, oh, that's a really good idea, that I'm going to take this in this direction versus that direction. So constant collaboration in that room. We did very rigorous blind data experiments. We would do bi-weekly end-to-end integration runs. In other words, people would work on their algorithm on the last version of the system, and every 2 weeks, if your algorithm was doing no harm, and only if it was doing no harm, you had the privilege of taking your updates and putting into the next big integration run. We'd integrate, and then we'd regress, and we'd say, okay, now let's see how we're doing, you know, with the whole everything all put together. Each of these bi-weekly ones would generate over 10 gigabytes of error analysis data, which we then had tools that we would slice and dice and try to understand what was really going on. And this was the key. What was going on? How do you take the next iteration of research if you didn't understand what was happening in this incredibly complex system? Over the 4 years, we did over 8,000 documented experiments. So we have a website where all the documents got logged, and at this point we have 7,761 experiments. You could dig into an experiment and you could see what the aggregate statistics were, how it's performing, its accuracy, its precision, its average, its confidence, and things like that. Then you'd be able to look at the actual questions in that data set, what it thought type of thing the answer was supposed to be, what its actual answer was, what its confidence was. Then you could drill into a particular question and you could see what were all its answers. And for each one of those answers, you see each column with a number between 0 and 1, there are, you know, 600 of these columns. So you look at those columns, and you look at these numbers between 0 and 1 to try to understand how these algorithms were influencing these answers, and what would happen. No, come on, be honest. What would happen? A human looking at 600 columns between, what would happen? Nothing. Nothing. You just go kind of go blind. But nonetheless, there were people who stand up and they would go, oh, I see what's going on. In fact, no, you don't. So, and that was the key thing. No, you don't. We need tools to understand what's going on. We need tools that help us plot you know, how any individual one of those algorithms or features were performing relative to their prediction of getting an answer right. So if you have some algorithm and its score, its confidence score is going from 0 to 120, whatever it does, as its confidence score was going up, was the likelihood that the answer would also go up? I hope so. Even though it would go very small, at least be going in the right direction. Actually, if you're going in the opposite direction, that's okay. We could just change the sign. Problem is, well, do you even know what direction it's going in? You know, is it bimodal? Is it going up? That's bad. Going up and going down. Well, it's not so bad. Well, it's bad if you don't know it. If you know it, you can slice it and create two features, then invert one, and you're predictive again. Right? But you don't know that until you have tools that help you understand how these features are behaving. How about this? Now we can say, well, how do they contribute relative to one another? So here's the question. It's a bit chilly today, is the category. Chile shares its longest land border with this country. And here's its top answers over here. So Argentina and Bolivia were at the top. Now we have all the hundreds of algorithms here. And what you very quickly see is a graph that says which algorithms are contributing to the right answer, so I'm comparing the two top answers, Bolivia and Argentina. So here's Argentina and Bolivia. So which algorithms are contributing to the right answer? Oh, look where the green bars are. The yellow bars are saying these algorithms are contributing to the wrong answer. I'll let you quickly zoom in. Now, this is with all the model weights and everything, so you know exactly what these contributions are. So then you can dig in and go, oh, that's what I have to pay attention to. I have to pay attention to those algorithms that are favoring the right one, favoring the wrong one, see what's going on, what's going right, what's going wrong. But there's still a lot of them. Ugh, my brain hurts. So, we can group them to make them more cognitively accessible. A whole bunch of algorithms related to geospatial information, passive support information, popularity, source reliability, how reliable is the source, type match classification. So now all those hundreds of features now, I'm not showing all the groupings, but some of them are represented under these groupings, which at least have to make some cognitive sense to you. This actually led to this notion of an evidence profile. I think it's really important because in the end, if you want to apply this technology outside of Jeopardy, you don't want to just give an answer with a number. What does it mean? Why do you believe that answer? Where, ultimately, as a human, I have to make a judgment. So you've done a lot of work, you Watson guy. Why are you coming up with this number? Right? So I want to see how you broke the evidence down. So if from a location perspective, I like Argentina. From passive support perspective, I like Argentina. Popularity perspective, I like Bolivia. Why? Turns out that there's a lot of big dispute between Bolivia and Chile over land dispute over a border. So a lot of noise out there, but it wasn't really giving you the answer. Source reliability. The sources that were giving evidence for Argentina were more reliable than the sources giving evidence for Bolivia. This might have been a lot of off stuff. Who knows? Classification, they were both, they're both countries. Good thing. So what happens is you could now imagine that you could drill into each one of these bars and actually get the evidence itself. I see. That's why. Right? So this kind of leads you into where do I want to look, and I can actually look at the evidence itself. You'll find Bethel College and Seminary in this holy Minnesota city. St. Paul, Minnesota, South Bend, Indiana. Well, come on, guys. I mean, it's a Minnesota city, right? It turns out there's a Bethel College and Seminary in both St. Paul, Minnesota, and South Bend, Indiana. But you think, well, gee, I mean, we all know the right answer. Well, Watson sort of did. It knew that St. Paul was in Minnesota. That was a good thing. It had negative evidence for South Bend because South Bend is in Indiana. But there was a lot more evidence in every other category for South Bend, Indiana. Watson should have never believed any of this because in a case like this, the location information should completely overwhelm all the other data. So the evidence profile would teach us something's wrong with how we're weighing the data. So we learn how to make it smarter, how to look at questions differently, and how to understand how to weigh information differently. Another thing, of course, is that it's holy. Which city is holier? St. Paul's holier, sure. And so someone actually wrote a pun detector, an algorithm that would look for pun relationships between words in the clue and answers. We put the pun detector in, trained it, and it earned weight. And it prefers St. Paul over South Bend. Of course, that wasn't the best way to get this. but I just make a point that you can come in with a new idea, write that idea, integrate it, and train, and it says, oh, it's predictive of the right answer. Now, of course, what it did, the pun relation detector boosted Holy Cross, well, Minnesota, well above South Bend, because after all, Holy Cross is holier than South Bend. So with the architecture, with the development of the algorithms, with the methodology that allowed us to iterate, advance those algorithms, we moved from that baseline all the way to that dark blue line, actually a little bit above that, was the system we played with against Shepard, just slicing right across the winner's cloud. This means that Watson can identify, don't forget, this is right, Watson knows how to rank. So in other words, they could say, if I order the questions based on my confidence and I cover 70% of them, and this ultimately, I'll get like 87 or 88% right over here. So anything with a higher confidence, I'm doing even better. We actually map the confidence to a probability successfully. So in other words, if I'm doing like here, if I'm doing 90% precision, my confidence was 90%. So if I'm 90% sure I'm getting it right, I would get 90% of those right. This was good enough to compete against champions. Does it mean you'd win every game? No, it doesn't. Because depending on the questions, depending on the categories, depending on the competition, depending on the speed, how quickly you can answer those questions, depending on the daily doubles, which is a lot of luck involved in that, all these things can change what the likelihood you'd win a game or not. Knowing that, as a scientist, it wasn't about that one game. As a professional with a career, it was all about that one game. As a scientist, it wasn't. I kept getting reminded of that by the senior VP. But as a scientist, it wasn't about that one game. We played 55 games, actually, formal games against tournament of champion players, people in the same league as Rutter and Jennings. And we won about 71% of those games. So that was statistically significant. But that means we went into that final game with roughly a 30% chance of losing. You can imagine what that felt like. It took about 2 hours to answer a single question on a 2.6 gigahertz CPU with about 16 gig of RAM. It took about 2 hours. Now, Jeopardy insisted that would make a very boring Jeopardy game. So, but again, because the architecture was embarrassingly parallel, it had these constant splits where you can pursue these answers and this evidence independently, we were able to parallelize the system and scale it out of the 2,880 cores. So the final system was on 2,880 cores, 15 terabytes of RAM, didn't go to disk, and that answered an average of about 3 seconds per question. It depends on the question, so it could take 8 seconds, could take one second, but about 3 seconds. This was fast enough to play and to compete against champions. In the lab, we actually had two systems, because one was optimized for development and one was optimized for latency. The one optimized for development, you could change the algorithms and not recompute all the data, or you wouldn't reanalyze all the data again. But what would happen was, every time you answered a question, depending on what point the system was optimized at different points, at one point it was taking 2 hours, but we got it maybe down to maybe an hour per question. So every CPU was running the entire system, answering a single question, taking an hour, but if we ran on 1,000 CPUs, we could answer 1,000 questions in an hour. This system was optimized for latency, meaning all the CPUs were running at the same time so that we can answer a single question in just 3 seconds. And we had both because this one was for production, for playing Jeopardy. This one was for development, where we could change things more quickly. So the rest of history here, we ended up winning the final game. That wasn't the final question. This was the answer panel. But that was the final score. What happened? The other point I want to make here is that, was Jeopardy a good challenge to take on from a scientific perspective? I mean, besides the AI thing, it's interesting to see, this machine that would take 20 there's 80 kilowatts of electricity and 20 tons of air conditioning. Compute against, you know, a human with a brain that fits in a shoebox, powered by a tuna fish sandwich and a glass of water. And it almost lost. I mean, it could have lost. Right? So that was really cool. But from a technology perspective, you know, when you talk about natural language parsing, entity disambiguation, finding entities and relationships in text, extracting facts from knowledge bases, whether or not one piece of text entails another, we call text entailment. These are all measurements that are regularly done in the NLP community. All our algorithms got substantially better. In fact, we have leading scores in all of these. What's interesting is we didn't, no researcher sat there and said, I'm going to try to get better at text entailment. No researcher said, I'm going to get better at this, I'm going to get better at that. They all worked to make the system win Jeopardy. And it was a good scientific hypothesis. It was a good challenge, I should say, because, in fact, it did drive all these component technologies to have leading scores, you know, in the industry, which was very nice, of course, to see in the state of life. You know, it's all about applications going forward. What do we do with this? You know, Jeopardy and beyond. What's beyond Jeopardy? And I think there are lots of areas where this kind of technology can help, but generally, areas where this, you know, really valuable knowledge and natural language resources that we want to kind of get at, understand better, and allow that knowledge to help inform decision making, help humans make better decisions leveraging that knowledge. So what is healthcare? It's kind of interesting to see how the way Watson works maps onto doing diagnosis or treatment assessment. So all of a sudden these dimensions of evidence can become the kind of things that you look for, like symptoms, family history, personal history, medications, findings. So we talked about an evidence profile. Here's an evidence profile. What it might look like in medicine. So, and when we combine all those scores, we get sort of a final confidence in a particular diagnosis, in this case, UTI, urinary tract infection. But, oh, you know, from a symptoms perspective, we like this diagnosis, you know, more than from a family history perspective. But imagine that I could drill in each of those and look at the information that's taking me there, look at the information that's supporting it. So getting from, you know, stuff taken from a patient interview and lab tests to EMR with family and personal history medications, test findings, huge volumes of text, journals, references, and databases, you can imagine the system becoming kind of this continuous process that's analyzing all this data and updating and computing these evidence profiles for these different possibilities. It could be diagnoses. It could be treatment options. In treatment options, there isn't necessarily a correct answer. They're basically different possible treatments that best match the input data based on the most current background information for different reasons. And you want to kind of know what that is, and you want to be able to collect and organize the information according to these evidence profiles. So this, you know, very interesting. So imagine an interface, you know, looking like this, we see uveitis, erititis, keratitis. We see the actual evidence profile, but now you're drilling in and you're seeing the actual, you know, from a textbook, from a website, from a medical journal, you're seeing the actual evidence itself that contributed to that. To that score for that, you know, for that data. So when we think about, I'll end on this slide, but when we think about where we need to go, you know, moving from Jeopardy and beyond, from the top, we see a couple of categories. You know, understanding the input of the question, interacting, explaining the answers, and learning, the continuous learning process. And then you see kind of the where we were with Jeopardy. So we're, you know, along here. Where we need to go. And with Jeopardy, we have specific questions. You know, like the type of murmur associated with this condition is harsh, systolic, and increases intensity with Valsalva. When you get a well-formed question, there's already a lot of data in that question because the person who formulated the question thought hard about, you know, what the answer is and how do I formulate the question. We need to go from a single question to just a bunch of data. You know, here's the electronic medical record. You know, even if it's not a medicine, here's everything I know. Tell me what my problem is. The question is always, what's my problem and how do I fix it? If you think about a medicine, what's the problem with the patient and how do I fix it? That's always the two main questions. But I have lots of data. How do I partition that data and figure out what questions do I ask, which data is worth pursuing and which isn't? So if you go from specific questions to really what we call rich problem scenarios. Question and answer out, well, you know, guess what? I mean, that's artificial, right? In Jeopardy, how many times Watson wanted to say to Alex, did you really mean, or APB, when you expand that, what did you intend for that to be? So, but you can do that. In the real world, you can. You can disambiguate questions. You can say, you know what, I'm not sure about this. I have this evidence, but I'm not really clear on it. And so being able to go from a question and answer out to a dialogue to help refine the question and to help build better confidence in answers or in what it's reading really makes more sense. We have to go from this question and answer out to really something that's more interactive dialogue. From the answer panel that you saw on Jeopardy, they're really those evidence profiles that we're showing you. It's not just the answer and the confidence. It's how am I weighing the different classes of evidence, and can I show you the evidence itself and let you decide? And ultimately, the training process itself, the teaching process, really wants the teaching process to ultimately be not just batch that you train, you know, every so often, but you're constantly training and you're constantly learning from the interaction of the system with the human. So you really want this to be a collaborative learning process that happens over time. The system's providing value, and you are working with the system as so that you're both learning as time goes on. So it's more of this continuous learning process. So this is kind of where we're going with Watson from a technical perspective, and of course the application, one of the application areas is the healthcare space. Thank you. So I'm very interested in that.
I didn't quantify this, so I can't validate it from a statistical standpoint. But in the third game, it seemed like the third to final.
Yeah.
It seemed like Watson had some hesitation where when it came to popular culture type questions.
Uh-huh.
And Ken seemed to see that Watson had a deficiency in that area, and he would automatically try to answer the popular culture questions. And it seemed like he was gaining the advantage. It may have been my imagination, but it just seemed something that.
It had no particular weakness in popular culture. It was hard, actually, to characterize its weaknesses from a category perspective. We learned early on that the categories didn't tell us a whole heck of a lot. But what told us more about whether or not Watson might be able to answer the question were the previous questions in that category. So it was hard. I mean, you know, we had one group who came in and saw Watson fail on a whole category having to do with knitting or something like that. And Watson just, you know, was like a train wreck. It just did really bad. But not for any reason, right? You know, it just didn't understand those questions and, you know, whatever. Because it's so variable on whether or not it could, you know, why? Because it depends on whether or not it could understand the question well enough, and then what it's reading and how it could relate when it read to that question. So it depends on what it's read too. You can't really know that. You think you can know, but you can't. So but everybody we get, and remember, we had a group in. Play Watson, and it's terrible, like on a food category and a knitting category. And the people said, Watson's a chauvinist. Why? Because clearly it doesn't do those categories that are related to women well enough. Really?
How significant was something like timing jitter that you would have to add his response time to simulate a human?
We didn't have to simulate a human. We had to use the same interface that humans did. So in other words, Watson had to push.
I asked if any of those time questions, you could see the other two had the answer, but they chimed in a slight fraction of a second too late, obviously. I'm wondering if that is Watson.
So again, the way this was calibrated was there's an interface to the Jeffrey system, which is you have to push a little plastic button down on a spring. Watson had to push that same plastic button. At that point on, it was human versus machine. Now, I can tell you the stats. So what happens is humans listen to the clue. Watson wasn't listening, so Watson, you know. And the way good expert humans do this is they listen to the cadence of the question, they time it. They try to get in right when that point is where the buzzer is enabled. And they do this remarkably well. So where they can come in less than 10 milliseconds. Watson, it took Watson's fastest buzz, because Watson had what was a confidence-weighted buzzer scheme. Depending on how confidence was, it would buzz faster or slower, up to a limit. The fastest it can buzz was about 10 milliseconds. So technically speaking, by listening and timing, a human can beat the computer to the buzz, and did. The human wasn't as consistently fast as Watson can be if Watson was able to come up with the confidence and the answer faster. So human could beat and often did Watson, but not consistently, again, you know, when they were both kind of ready and able and ready to go. But humans sometimes are faster at just computing the answer and the confidence. In fact, in the air game, and again, we played many games and you saw all kinds of weird things happening. You know, in fact, one, it was interesting because often you'd have a human. But by the way, the classic thing to complain about when you're a Jeopardy player is that someone else is cheating on the buzzer. This is what you do. This is part of the culture, right? So what happened was nice when you had two humans because we had one person sitting there saying, it's absolutely impossible to beat Watson to the buzzer. Meantime, the other human was beating Watson every time, you know, through an entire category, so they couldn't complain. You know, but it's so frustrating when you know the answer and you miss that buzzer. It's so, believe me, because I could sympathize with Watson. When we knew the answer and missed that thing, I was dying. In the you just hate it. In the actual air game, Watson lost an entire category to the humans because they were short clues. It was like directors who act or something. Watson had the right answer at over 90% confidence and lost every single one. They're like, painful. Sorry.
I'm really excited about your extending it to the medical field, and I wonder whether the next show would be, you know, you playing against Dr. His name, House. But apart from that, are you really aiming it at the difficult diagnoses, or are you really looking at providing diagnostic tools for every physician?
I mean, I don't know that there's a single answer to that. I can tell you what we're really focused on scientifically, but there's also a commercial effort. And I think the commercial effort is being more driven by talking to customers and figuring out what their pain points are, how do we adapt the technology to really solve the problem that a hospital or institution, insurance company, whatever, is facing. You know, where are the costs going? How do we actually help them manage the healthcare process better? From a scientific perspective, it's really, can I understand the input relative to the content? Can I draw, if you will, an inference graph from the input to the most likely diagnosis to the likely treatments, and can I annotate that graph with the right evidence from the huge volumes of content that are out there? And that's the way we ultimately want to evaluate Watson. And it shouldn't, you know, was it a hard question? Was it an easy question? Well, that's the same thing with it's very hard to determine how you measure whether it was hard or difficult. You know, we went, as an example, in the Jeopardy case, we were analyzing our performance on historical Jeopardy games, and we would randomly sample, you know, from the games, build a random set, and we would test the performance. And, you know, we were getting a certain, you know, performance, pretend it was here. And I used to talk a lot about how, you know, the game is constantly changing, it's not formulaic, you know, it's evolving, you know, blah, blah, blah. And one of the researchers said, you know, that's a good point. I have to order the data chronologically. And they did that. And it was a shock, because what happened was the performance went like this, and boom, like that. In 2003, the performance changed by almost 10%. What happened? Were the questions harder? Humans weren't finding them harder. Why was all of a sudden the computer failing on questions post-2003? Something changed. So the best way of characterizing what changed was the language that was used in the questions was further removed from the language that was used in the content. You know, Jeopardy, you know, got kind of more entertaining and more comical and more this in the way they were formulating the questions. I mean, were they intrinsically harder? So it's hard to say. The computer can find things, you know, hard that humans find easy, and, you know, and vice versa. So I think when humans think hard, they think lots of inference steps. I had to go from here, then to there, then to there, then to there. I had to do 5 steps of inference. I had to do 6 steps of inference. That's one way of thinking about hard. Another way of thinking about hard is not common knowledge. In other words, it's obscure.
Yeah.
Computer's good at obscurity.
Yeah.
Right? Because they can look at all the information that you don't remember.
Yeah.
Right? So there's different ways to measure that.
So, one last question. Go ahead, Mark.
So you talked a lot about algorithms and how you go through the process of screening for what's contributing and what's not. What about knowledge representation, and were there any sort of strategic shifts along the way, you know, as you got to higher performance levels, et cetera?
So, you know, from an organization perspective, you know, we didn't expect that there was going to be one ontology for Jeopardy, but rather that we had to assimilate many different ontologies and use them as just other sources of evidence for classifying things and for relating things. And we did that. So, you know, we used WordNet, we used Jago, we used Lisp, we used WikiCat, we very, very loosely formed and formally structured ontologies of sort of every kind as sources of information that will contribute to an interpretation of a phrase or how to relate one word to another word. So we were very liberal in our use of that. And in some parts of the system, there were kind of formal axiomatic kinds of things, and in other parts, there wasn't. So we were not bigoted about this. You know, it was more driven by, I have an algorithm where I can capture some phenomenon that we seem to be missing on, and that algorithm is going to depend on more of a formal representation. Right, but if you looked at the bulk of contributions from the system, those relatively small was coming from more of the the structure of knowledge representation part, but nonetheless it was there, and there were clearly opportunities to continue and expand it. We expect that there will be more of that actually in medicine.
I think we should close and wait. So we'll close this part. It's going to stay around, so I don't know, you have to leave.
Okay.
We'll get back. So for those of you who have questions, just come on up. So for me,